Okay, it looks like we are now live. I want to welcome everyone this afternoon to a special time where we can get a COVID-19 update from Dr. Roger Schwelt. Again, we're so thankful that you're willing to take time to give us this update, and I'd like to begin with prayer, asking that God will bless our time together. So please bow your heads with me, and then we'll turn the time over to him. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we are thankful for your goodness and your love. We are thankful that you are in full control of all things. And again, we just ask that you will bless our time together as we think upon these things and how we can be helpful in this time of crisis. Thank you again. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, Dr. Schwelt, thank you again for joining us. The time is yours.
Thank you very much, Rodney. So good afternoon, everyone. And today is March 21st, and we're talking about the COVID-19, which is the disease caused by SARS-CoV-2, the RNA virus, which has literally taken the world by storm. Started in late December, and now we are more than halfway through March, and we're starting to see a pandemic. Wanted to kind of bring you up to where we had talked about last week and where we are this week. Obviously, a lot of changes have happened in the last week, and they're all related to trying to work towards reducing the amount of demand that is going to be needed on the healthcare system here in the United States and around the world. And we're seeing images on our news feed, on our televisions, about what is going around the world. We can see here in Italy, coronavirus patients, it says, on apocalypse ward, gasp in bubble helmets as army move bodies. And you can see that these patients are being hospitalized in Italy. And there has been a lot of issues regarding that. Right now, Italy has surpassed China in the number of dead, at least officially, and also in terms of the number of infected. I think the purpose of what I'm going to do today is tell you where we are right now, what the strategies are that have been employed here in this country, what is the possible things on the horizon, and what we can do. I think one of the most important things to understand right now is the way we're practicing medicine is not the same as we're going to be going forward. There's going to be different rules. I think a catchphrase would be, the good is not the enemy of the perfect. What is the perfect? The perfect is the world that we used to know in terms of how we practice medicine. We had enough equipment. We had enough supplies. We didn't use medication unless we had evidence for it. We would need to have a randomized controlled trial, double-blinded placebo-controlled trial, before the FDA would approve a medication. Those are all very good things in a very controlled situation. But when you have an emergency situation, and by all counts, what we have right now is an emergency situation. I am a pulmonary critical care physician, and I work at a hospital. And our hospitals, both of them that I work at, are preparing for an emergency situation. We have had the benefit in this country of seeing other countries going through what we are about to go through. And there are certain things that we need to do to prepare for that. And they are preparing for that. But I wanted to show you what really we are up against and why we're under the isolation things, because it's very important for you to understand. This video, in my estimation, the information I'm about to show you in this video is probably one of the most important videos that you're going to see all year in terms of what to do to prepare for that. So please, if there's anybody that's around, sit them down and watch what we're about to go through, because it's extremely important for you and your family and your loved ones. So what I'm showing you here is a PDF that is a study that was published from the Imperial College in Great Britain, looking at what they are preparing for in terms of hospitalization. You can see here is a table looking at different age groups, 0 to 9. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to blow this up a little bit more so you can see it better. 0 to 9, the number, first column is the number of symptomatic cases requiring hospitalization. The second column is the number of hospitalized cases requiring critical care. And the last column is the infection fatality ratio. This is based on the current estimates based on what they had seen. So you can see here, 0 to 9, very, very low cases. All the way up finally to 80 plus years of age, and the percent requiring hospitalization upward of 27%. Percent requiring critical care, 70% of those hospitalized patients. And then the infection fatality ratio is about 9.3%. All to say this is if you take and you look at the population and you look at the number of people that are deemed to be infected, the statistics show that about 80%, that's a very important number, 80% of the people who will come down with this infection will not need to seek medical attention at the hospital. But about 20% of those patients will need some sort of hospitalization or at least medical evaluation. And in that 20%, about a quarter of them, so about 5% of the overall population, roughly, will need critical care beds. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, just 20%, but we're talking about tens of millions of people in just the state of California, potentially, that might get infected. And we're talking about even more millions of people in the United States, not to even mention worldwide. And so when you multiply that 20% by a very, very large denominator, the entire fraction becomes so large that you could potentially and will overwhelm the ability for the healthcare resources to deal with you and to take care of you. And that is why, and so there's two issues to this. I want to be very clear about this. There is the demand side of the equation, the demand side being the population, the percentages that need care side of the equation. That is, how many hospital beds do we have? How many ventilators do we have? How many physicians do we have? How many nurses, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, respiratory therapists, pharmacists? It's an all hands on deck situation. And so they obviously, to quell or to prevent this huge surge from hitting the hospital all at the same time, which is what would happen if you had all of these people intermingling and passing this virus, which is very infective all around. It would be a huge tidal wave, a tsunami hitting this hospital. And so what they're trying to do is flatten out that curve. And I'll show you here in the study as we scroll down some of the things. You can see that they've done some calculations. This is the sobering graph that I want you to understand. Here, this black curve that's going up is the do nothing curve. And you can see that the number of people that they're expecting over here on the far left is March 20. Okay. And as you can see here on March 20, that's where we are right now. So this is obviously, this is the common. Many people are saying, you know, people die of the flu every year. We haven't seen any deaths. What is the big deal? Why are we, this is the government trying to usurp power. Yeah, that very well may be in some situations. You know, the government is not monolithic. There are a lot of people in the government, but what they're doing is for a good reason, because you can see if we do nothing, there is a very, very large tidal wave that is going to hit the healthcare system. And so people who need that healthcare system for other things, not even COVID-19, let's say they get a pneumonia from another reason, or they have diabetic issues, or they have high blood pressure issues, or they need surgery, they have a gallbladder attack, it's going to be so saturated that they're not going to be able to get that surgery. Here, if we close schools and universities, then we have the green curve. So again, it's bad, but it's less bad than doing nothing. What about case isolation? Okay, this is what the effect would be. If we did case isolation and household quarantining, this is what the yellow curve would be. And if we did all of those, case isolation, home quarantine, social distancing of greater than 7-year-olds, we could get this curve down to blue. So there's a lot of things that we can do. The problem is that this red line, which I haven't mentioned up to this point, is the capacity of our healthcare system, at least according to this paper in the UK. And the UK is not that much different from here in the United States. So you can see that even though we're doing all of these things, there is going to be a huge problem. And to bring it a little bit closer to home, I can quote what the governor of New York, Governor Cuomo said. He's put out some actual numbers. He's playing very fair. He's telling you straight up. It's very sobering. They anticipate that they will need to have 37,000 ventilators at the peak of their epidemic in New York State. And they have only 3,000. Okay. They anticipate 110,000 beds. They only have 53,000 beds. And so we're trying to be very creative in medicine. I'm part of a planning committee here locally about what we're going to do. There is talk about taking ventilators and ventilating two people with one ventilator at the same time. That way you can double the effect of a number of people while you're waiting for new ventilators to come in. Of course, there are very famous CEOs who own very large car companies that are turning their companies over to making ventilators as quickly as they possibly can to meet this demand. We are taking ventilators and ventilating two people. Clearly, this is not the perfect. This is the less than perfect that we're talking about. So you can see that this is what we're doing. And there's been a lot of attention being made to the supply side of this equation. Again, the beds, the hospitals, the ventilators to meet this surge. And we're also trying to do a lot on the demand side. And how are we doing that? It's with this isolation. And that's the reason why I'm not there at Mentone Church for this presentation, and you're not there, and I can't see your faces. And this is the reason why we're on the internet, because viruses of this type, coronavirus, can't travel through the internet. There are other viruses that can travel through the internet, but that's why we have our antiviruses loaded on the computer, and they don't kill. So you can see here that there's a number of statistics that have gone into this, and people are very up to date on what's going on. They have a lot of different things, and you can look at that study that was put out by the Imperial College. So let's go back a little bit and talk, because when we're looking at something like this, we have to come up with an idea of why is this happening and what should we do about it? And that's what I did when I was looking at this, is let's take a picture and look back at what it is that's going on. Because when you're put into a situation like this, you have to think big. You have to mobilize. There's nothing that is off the table in these kinds of situations. So in my mind, I thought, well, when was the last time something like this happened in our country? And what did we do about it? And I'm taken back to the 1918 to 1919 pandemic of influenza, which was a horrible pandemic. And it hit particularly the young and able. When I say young, I'm talking about people in their 20s and 30s. These were people that had just come back from the First World War. They had just battled and they'd come home, and this is when the Spanish flu epidemic hit, and it hit hard. To give you an idea, the case fatality rate was somewhere in the range of 10%. For some individuals, for some classes, it was as high as 30%. For instance, pregnant women suffered about 30% case fatality rate if they were to catch the influenza virus. And so this paper that I'm showing you here goes back and looks at what it was that happened. Now, this actually is a story that kind of meets up with us today, because one of the medications that had just come out in the 1918 to 1919, actually about 20 years earlier in 1899, was Bayer aspirin. And aspirin was an NSAID, and it was a great medication that could be used to treat fever. And so this paper goes over what it was that happened with salicylates during that time. They talk about the high case fatality rate, especially among young adults. What the philosophy was at that time was that a lot of people were dying of the flu, they felt, was because of the high fevers. And they felt that by giving more and more aspirin, they could treat the fever and save the patient. So they obviously, sometimes they gave so much aspirin that the patient became toxic. And they felt that a lot of people were dying. Now, they couldn't give this aspirin. They knew they couldn't give aspirin to pediatric patients because they would develop Reye's syndrome. And as it turns out, the young that did not get aspirin actually had a better case fatality rate. So just to show some of the highlights, when you looked at the aspirin regimens in 1918, we could see that by today's standard, they would have produced toxicity. Salicylates cause immediate lung toxicity and may predispose to bacterial infection by increasing lung fluid and protein levels and impairing mucociliary clearance. That was another thing that they had found out. And then they looked at the two kinds of deaths that they saw in this flu pandemic, those that died very quickly, which they felt might have been due to aspirin, and those that died very slowly from the virus-produced pathology. There was also official recommendations put out at the time to use aspirin. And this happened right before the early October death spike in 1918. So there's a lot of evidence that people are putting together, some of them circumstantial. So understand that aspirin was the standard of care in dealing with the flu epidemic. So that led me to a little bit more understanding. And there's this a paper that was published in 2012 looking at fever management. The evidence versus current practice. And what that, they present two different types of concepts here. The concepts that saying that fever is harmful and that we should treat it. And the other side of it, that the evidence that a fever is actually beneficial. What I found interesting is fever, it says here, exerts an overall adverse effect on the growth of bacteria and on the replication of viruses. Okay, and there's some papers to back that up. It also enhances immunological processes, including activity of interleukin-1, T helper cells, cytolytic T cells, B cell, and immunoglobulin synthesis. The mobility, phagocytosis, and killing of bacteria by polymorphonuclear leukocytes are significantly greater at temperatures above 40 degrees centigrade. A fever is defined, for those who don't know, at 38 degrees centigrade. And at that temperature, it says here, they have a direct positive effect on lymphocyte transformation, the generation of cytolytic cells, B cell activity, and immunoglobulin synthesis. IL-1 is more active at febrile temperature than at afebrile temperature. And interferon, a potent antiviral agent, has enhanced antiviral activity above 40 degrees. And so what I think starts to emerge is this feeling, at least in me, that giving and treating a fever that is naturally generated when you have an infection may actually impair your ability to fight infection, but it could also be that during 1918 that they were receiving toxic doses of aspirin as well. And so what I think what we're headed towards here is, let's go back to that curve, that tidal wave that's about to hit the healthcare delivery system that can't handle it. Let me give you a little bit more illustration about what I'm talking about. Earlier this week, there was some discussion from the White House that hydroxychloroquine may be beneficial and should be used in the treatment of COVID-19 patients. This is not based on a randomized placebo-controlled trial. This is based on a small study, although a very promising study out of the south of France that showed after about 5 or 6 days that hydroxychloroquine in combination with azithromycin was able to basically take 95% of the patients in the study to have no detectable virus whatsoever, as compared to the control arm, which still showed almost all of the patients having virus in them. Again, what would we need to have to say that this is actually the medicine that we should use? It should be a large, randomized, placebo-controlled trial. Even though we don't have that data, I can tell you personally that there are physicians in the hospital that are ready to use this medication to treat these patients if and when they show up. Fortunately, I'm at a hospital where we haven't had yet a confirmed case, but we are ready and we expect those to happen in the next week or two based on what we're seeing at area hospitals. The CDC understands that there is personal protective equipment that is now running out. And they say on their own site that bandanas and scarves could be used as personal protective equipment. Once again, highlighting this issue, we are in an emergency situation that the good is not the enemy of the perfect. So what we're do we have evidence that a scarf or a bandana might be beneficial? No, but we have to realize that the goal in terms of medicine and being a practitioner is not to practice perfect medicine. The goal is to save someone's life. And so what we have to do is, instead of saying we're going to practice medicine and if you don't fit into our small box, then we're not going to treat you at all, because the consequences of that is death. We don't treat you at all. What we have to do is we have to use our minds rationally and say, this is the benefit and this is the risk. And if there's something that could potentially have benefits but has very low risk, then that's something that we might be able to bring to the table. But even in this situation, after the president announced the promising findings of hydroxychloroquine earlier this last week, within the same day, I called around to different pharmacies and that medication was unavailable, even though it had been available in the weeks prior. And the two hospitals that I work at were unable to get those medications anymore from their pharmacy suppliers. And so what we have here is the same situation that we're seeing in Costco. As soon as there is an emergency, the toilet paper is gone. The water is gone. As soon as we find a medication, and we're very lucky in this situation because it could have taken us years to find the antiviral that does the thing, and it might not have been in production, and we might not have a good safety profile. But here with hydroxychloroquine, this is a medication that's been around for decades. We know exactly how it behaves. We know exactly what the consequences of it are, and we have factories that are already making it. And still, even in that situation, even in the most optimistic situation, we're having a hard time trying to get that medication out to where it's needed in our current medical delivery system. Fortunately, there is a factory that is saying that it's going to donate its supply, millions and millions of tablets, to the medical infrastructure here in the United States. And there's another factory that used to make it that will start making it immediately to meet that demand. But the point is this, is that if we look at this from purely a supply side situation, if we look at it as only, the only way to this solution is to isolate and ramp up medical causes, we're missing, I believe, a substantial area that we could affect change and reduce that. And what is that? Well, remember what I said at the very beginning. At the very beginning of this talk, I said that 80% of the patients that get this virus will not need medical attention. And why is that? And there's one simple answer. The answer is because of their immune system. And that's been the big black box that we haven't talked about. Why is it that some people's immune system are able to fight this virus successfully to the point where they get a mild reaction and then they're able to get better? And we know the answer to that because we've seen the data. As you get older, we know that people's immune systems become weaker and weaker and weaker. And that's exactly the population that we are seeing this in, is the elderly population. And I think the reason for that is because of a whole host of reasons. There's organ system issues, there's the immune system, of course. But the question remains, and it's a very tempting question, if we were to somehow augment the immune system in millions of people who are willing to do it, would we be able to prevent this surge from happening? And I'm not saying that we would do this in isolation or exclusive to anything else. As I mentioned, this is an all on the table situation. All hands have to be on deck and all angles need to be evaluated. So what I want to talk about are two things that I believe that we personally, but also as advocates for patients and advocates for our family and people all over the world, need to understand that I think that they can do to help them, first of all, avoid the hospital, and number two, by doing so, avoid the surge. So these two things have to have very strict criteria, because remember, we can't even get hydroxychloroquine, which is made in a factory, to the hospital. There is a shortage of that. And so this has to be something that you can't go to the supermarket for. Otherwise, there would be a run on the supermarket. This is something that we're in isolation. We can't go out and get this. There has to be something that would augment our immune systems in such a degree, even a slight amount would be beneficial, that we don't have to leave our homes for, and that we're able to do without leaving our house. Remember, if 80% of all the patients who get sick don't have to go to the hospital, that if we are able to take that effect and only increase it by 5% to 85, what that would do is that would reduce by 25% the amount of patients that would need hospitalization. So there could actually be mathematically a huge effect if everybody did it and there was even just a small effect in terms of that. So what are the two things? The first thing that I'm going to talk about, I have very good evidence for, no question about it. The second one, so that's perfect evidence for the first one. The second one that I have is I have less than perfect, maybe good evidence for. But as I said before, we're not in a situation right now where we can practice perfect medicine, because the good is not the enemy of the perfect. We don't have time for randomized placebo-controlled trials. We have to look at everything and look at the good and look at the risks and make a determination. Does the benefits outweigh the risks? So let's talk about that. The first thing that I want to talk about is sleep. So sleep is something that you don't have to go out to the store for. You don't have to buy it. For those of you who are not in California, you may not be in isolation, or in New York, you may not be in isolation, but we are. And now you have absolutely no excuse. You don't have to get up early in the morning necessarily to beat traffic to get into your work if you do work. And since you don't have anywhere else to go and you have to come home, there's nothing else for you to do when you get home. And so I want to show you briefly just two studies that are very, very powerful. So the first study is a study here that has to do with effective sleep deprivation on response to immunization. And basically what the results of this study showed was that when you are vaccinated in a sleep-deprived situation, the antibody titers against that vaccination are less than half of what they are if you are getting a full night's sleep. Okay, now that has obvious ramifications when we're talking about a virus, because in this situation, they actually use the vaccination of a virus to do it. Okay, so that was using healthy subjects. The other one that I want to show you is this study that was published back in 2009, and it's called Sleep Habits and Susceptibility to the Common Cold. Okay. And so we can see here that in this study, they took 153 healthy men and women ages 21 to 55 for 14 consecutive days. And they looked at two things, the duration of sleep and the efficiency of sleep. And what they found, and during this process, what they did was they actually had a solution full of rhinovirus. And I don't know who would do this study except for maybe starving students or something like that. But basically, you were sleep deprived. And in one arm, and in the other arm, they were allowed to sleep as long as they wanted to. And they took droppers and they dropped rhinovirus in everybody's nostrils, and they monitored for symptoms of the flu. Well, do you know that those that were sleep deprived were, sit down for this, not 20% more, not 50% more, not 100% more, three times more likely to get a cold from the rhinovirus than those that had adequate sleep? And so their conclusion was that poor sleep efficiency, so not just duration, but also efficiency, in the weeks preceding an exposure to rhinovirus were associated with lower resistance to illness. And I can, we can show you the reference for that as well. What were the numbers there? Then they divided the group into those that slept less than 7 hours a night and those that slept more than 8 hours a night. And I know you're thinking out there, well, I can't sleep. I understand. But now what we have, if you have insomnia, we need to work on that. If on the other hand, you're just choosing to go to bed later because you're working on things or on your internet or you're looking on your phone, you don't have much of an excuse nowadays because there's not a lot of places to go. And now there's a real reason to make this a high priority in terms of sleep. So again, you're not going to have to run out to the store to buy sleep. If you're not going to get to Costco, and when you get to the shelf, realize that the shelf with all the sleep on it is gone. This is something that you can have anytime you need to. And this can really, more than you would think, protect you from getting a virus. Okay, so there is some pretty good evidence regarding this. Okay, the second thing that I wanted to talk about, and you know, this was something that I wanted to look at a little bit more deeply, and I did. And what we found out was that goes back to what we talked about in this first article, which was fever. I started to think about this. Fever is actually, or heat, is something that can kill viruses, as we talked about. So we all know that during the summer months, people don't get colds. I mean, that's why we call it a cold, because we get it in the winter months. There's been some discussion and talk about how the virus is affected by heat. And the hope is that as we move closer and closer into spring and summer, that the increased heat is going to dissipate the spread of this virus. I certainly hope it does. There is some interesting information that has come out about coronavirus. There was a recent study that looked at its characteristics on surfaces, copper, metals, cardboard, etc. What they found was that when you went from 68 degrees to 86 degrees, that was an increase of 18 degrees Fahrenheit, that the time span of survival of that virus was cut in half. Okay, so that's at 86 degrees. What would happen if you raise that up to 100 degrees? I'm sure it would shrink even more. That has nothing to do with where the virus is, but the temperature that the virus is in. So we started to think about fever and heat, and of course, started to think about what would happen if we did hydrotherapy. So what is hydrotherapy? Hydrotherapy is a situation where you use water to transmit heat to the specific area. Before I get to that though, I want you to kind of zoom back with me and think about this. So we are in a situation, in a completely different situation that we were in back in 1918. Back in 1918, I think they realized that they may have killed a lot of people with aspirin. And as a result of this, we started to introduce things in this country to make sure something like that would never happen again. That's how we got the FDA. That's how we started doing randomized placebo-controlled trials. We were not going to give medications to people if it wasn't going to be of benefit for them. And so what turned out, probably not as a forethought, wasn't willful, is that we started to develop medications that the only way these medications could get to market is if there was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. Well, these things were very expensive. And the only way you could get these things to market was if there was a financial benefit to pay back that testing. And so essentially what we have now today, because we've gone down this path in the last 100 years, is the only things that are indicated for diseases like this are medications that have to be made and have to be delivered and have to be assessed and checked for safety and prescribed by doctors. And all of these things have a finite source. In other words, if you overwhelm the system, then you cannot get any of this stuff. And so what we needed to do, as we talked about, is look for something that is outside of that delivery system. Because as I already described to you, hydroxychloroquine is becoming difficult. And if we have a surge like this, how do we know that we're not going to have that medication? How do we know? Hydrotherapy requires heat and it requires water. And those two things are available in everybody's house at this point. And if it's not, if we go to third world countries, there are fires, there's water, there's cold water there as well. So this is something potentially that would fit the criteria that we've talked about. That criteria being that it doesn't have to be delivered. You don't need to wait necessarily for a test to see if you have coronavirus. You don't have to wait for a doctor to see you to necessarily give you the treatment of the medication. And yet this can reduce the surge. If we go back to the original papers that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at it, the median time from infection of the coronavirus to symptoms is about 5 days. The median time from the initial onset of symptoms to shortness of breath requiring hospitalization is 7 to 8 days. So we're looking here at about 7 to 8 days where you have symptoms that are getting worse, body aches, fever, perhaps shortness of breath eventually, where you may be spending precious time trying to get tested and trying to get a prescription for things that might not exist in that kind of a surge. And so what to do? Well, it's got to be available in your home. So let's go back 100 years and see what we were doing before the FDA existed, before there were ICUs, before there were ventilators. What was the standard of care? You'll be surprised to know that the standard of care at that time, and pretty much for probably hundreds of years in just about every culture, was hydrotherapy. You can see here, here's an excerpt from a book that was published at the turn of the century. And you can see here that the reports on the local application of cold in acute pneumonia with an analysis of 299 cases treated in this manner by physicians residing nearly in all parts of the United States. This was a remarkable collection as the cases were distributed from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast, and only 10 deaths were reported, a death rate being 3.35%. This is bacterial pneumonia. This is not the Spanish flu. But that, of course, is an incredible mortality rate. This is what we did. And so to say at this point that one should do nothing between the onset of symptoms to hospitalization would not be going back 100 years. It would be going back to the Middle Ages. It would be going back even further than that. I'm sure they were probably doing hydrotherapy in the Middle Ages. So the question is, we've gone down this road, and now for some reason we think that the only thing that we can actually give, the only thing that is effective, is stuff that the FDA has approved. Let me just tell you right now at this point, I have absolutely no randomized placebo-controlled trials that sleep works in coronavirus. I have absolutely no randomized placebo-controlled trials that show that hydrotherapy works in coronavirus. If I had to sit here as the FDA chief and tell you, would I recommend these two things? The answer would have to be no, because I don't have those things. And that's what we need in a perfect medical world. But we are no longer in a perfect medical world. We are in a world where the CDC is recommending scarves and bandanas for personal protection if we run out of PPE. And so the question is what is the evidence for hydrotherapy in this kind of situation? Something that is available to everyone at home. Let's take a look and see what the clinical status is of hydrotherapy in an evidence-based retrospective six-year review. I don't want to go through all of this, but as you can see, I'm going to shrink it a little bit here so we can get the whole thing on there. There is huge literature to go through, okay? From not just coronavirus, there's physical fitness, conventional therapy. I'm not going to, and you can see here all of these studies that looked at for multiple sclerosis, for instance. Anyway, I want to show you that this is not an area, a field that hasn't been looked at. It's definitely an area that's been looked at and will continue. But what about our discussion here with about coronavirus? Here's a study that I found that was done in human beings, not in mice, not in rats, but in human beings. And it's called Immune Changes in Humans During Cold Exposure, Effects of Prior Heating and Exercise. Before we go on, let me describe for you what the practice of hydrotherapy is. Essentially, what it is about 4 to 6 times a day, somebody who is suffering from a viral pneumonia gets, for all intents and purposes, a very, very hot towel that is in boiling water, taken out, wrapped in other towels so it doesn't burn, and placed on the chest in the front and on the chest or the back here on the back, so that you're basically sandwiched between those two. It can also include a foot bath as well. And the purpose of this is for this heat to basically penetrate down as deep as possible into the chest. Some studies say as deep as 2 to 5 inches. And you can imagine if you apply it from the back and the front, there's not going to be a lot of lung that is left over when you apply from both sides 2 to 5 inches. As it turns out, in a study that was done looking at coronavirus and CT scans, high-resolution CT scans, the classical appearance of atypical pneumonia is ground glass opacifications that are peripherally placed in the lung. So these would make themselves certainly amenable to heat coming from the outside. They're in a perfect position to get that. The The reason why that that's the case is because the ACE2 receptor is located very, very deep into the respiratory epithelium. But here, these immune changes during cold exposure, before we go on. So the heat is placed for about 15 to 20 minutes. Sometimes you have to change the towels out because they lose their heat. And then at the end of that, a very cold towel, ice towel, is placed directly on the skin so that the cold can then cause vasoconstriction. And what happens at that point is very interesting. And this paper really documents what they found. Anyway, they go through the study. They talk about its blood sampling, immunophenotyping. And what they find is, I'll get down to the actual graphs, is that these different things like leukocytes, granulocytes, lymphocytes, monocytes, all of these things after cold exposure go up dramatically. What we think is happening is there's something called demargination. Usually the white cells are hanging around the edge of the vasculature. And when there's vasoconstriction, they get knocked off and they go to their lymph nodes. They get the information that they need and they go out and fight. Let me give you a little bit of a summary of some of these cases that we found. So going from warm to cold exposure, there was increased leukocytes, increased granulocytes, increased IL-6, and increased natural killer cells. Now, what does that mean? We have an army in this country, we have a military in this country, but the military is made up of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard, and on and on. Each one of these things have a specific function, but they all work together to defend the country. These parts of the leukocytes, the lymphocytes, the granulocytes, the interleukins, the plasma cells, the natural killer cells also work together under the umbrella of the immune system, but they all have a particular and different function. There's another study that shows that if you have daily cold exposure, so if you have a hot shower and then you have cold at the end of it, these things increase cytotoxic T cells. These are the things that go out and actually destroy the virally infected cells to get rid of it. T lymphocytes, natural killer cells, cell-mediated immunity, increases tumor necrosis factor alpha, IL-2, IL-6. These are all things that we've documented with hot and cold in terms of the cytokines. So the question is, these are statistically significant, by the way. And so we get down to the bottom of this. So they talk about natural killer cell activity, lymphocyte subsets, plasma hormone levels. They have absolutely no idea why this stuff is happening. They have theories, but they don't know why it's happening. And so you can see here more graphs, and they all show the same thing, that there is immunobenefits to cold exposure. Why did they do this study? You know what happens when, you know, your mom used to say, don't go out in the cold, you'll catch a virus, right? You all remember that, right? Well, this is what their conclusion was at the end of the study. Conclusions. This study suggests that despite popular beliefs that cold exposure can precipitate a viral infection, the innate component of the immune system is not adversely affected by a brief period of cold exposure. Indeed, the opposite seems to be the case. The fall in core body temperature resulting from cold exposure led to a consistent and statistically significant mobilization of circulating cells, an increase in natural killer cell activity, and elevations in circulating IL-6 concentrations. Moreover, in agreement with one of our hypotheses, prior exercise with a thermal clamp, this is where they heated them up, significantly augmented the leukocyte, granulocyte, and monocyte response to cold exposure. Prior passive heating and exercise without a thermal clamp also tended to augment the effect of cold exposure alone, but because of the small sample size and intersubject variability, these changes were not statistically significant. So what about real-time stuff? Here's a situation where they actually took mice and they gave them a toxic dose of Toxoplasma gondii in their peritoneums. And when they exposed them to cold water, the ones that were exposed to cold water actually survived statistically significantly longer from the infection than those that were not exposed to it. Okay, so do I have any randomized placebo-controlled data? I told you, I don't. I don't have any randomized controlled data at all. But I want you to remember that going back to the Spanish flu, there was about a 10% mortality rate associated with the Spanish flu, okay? So let's go to one of the Adventist publications called the Northern Union Reaper. That doesn't sound like a very good name for a paper, but nevertheless, there is the paper. So I want you to show you, and I'm going to read you this article that was printed at that time back in 1918 or thereabouts at the height of the Spanish flu. Okay? So this is in Hutchinson, Minnesota. I don't have a randomized placebo-controlled trial, but this is a very interesting case control study that I want to show you, okay? On the authority of Dr. Fred Shepard, health officer of Hutchinson City, it may be stated that no public institution in the state of Minnesota has to date made a record in handling influenza, the worldwide epidemic that has swept millions into their graves, like that to the credit of Hutchinson Seventh-day Adventist Seminary. The seminary, with 120 of its 180 students and teachers housed under one roof, that is a disaster, by the way, for a flu outbreak, was invaded by the malady 3 weeks ago. Symptoms of the malady developed with some 90 of these, and under the direction of Dr. H.E. Larson, a graduate physician, member of the seminary faculty, every person showing indication of sickness was at once put to bed with a trained nurse taking temperature and watching for symptoms of the epidemic. If those symptoms developed, the patient was required to remain in bed. Remember what we talked about, sleep and rest. There were no drugs to be given. Think about that. No drugs to be given. This is an important statement because at the time, remember, aspirin was being used extensively. Okay? And let me just stay here a bit. I know that many of you are on aspirin, and it's for a good reason. You might have a stent. I'm not telling you to get off your aspirin. It may be because you have a history of a stroke. Please do not get on your aspirin. Remember, we talked about risk versus benefit. The benefit that you're deriving if your physician has put you on aspirin could be much more than what we're talking about here. So please, whatever you do, make sure you talk to your physician first. You don't want to just follow one thing without thinking about other things as well. If those symptoms developed, the patient was required to remain in bed. There were no drugs to be given, but with complete rest and quiet went a carefully regulated diet and fomentations. Fomentation is describing that hot towel I was talking about with the hydrotherapy. So what did they do? They did rest, they did a very specifically regulated diet, and they did fomentations. Do you see anything about being tested for influenza? I think it's a great idea if you have the opportunity to be tested for influenza, you should do it. But you don't have to do it to be able to do this. If you're sick, you can do this. If the opportunity is there for you to take hydroxychloroquine when you get to the hospital, that's great. We have some data that shows that hydroxychloroquine could get rid of the virus within 6 days, which is a lot better than if you had nothing at all. But the question is if there's a surge, what do we do in that situation? I would rather do something than nothing. Let's keep reading. There were no drugs to be given, but complete rest and quiet when a carefully regulated diet and fomentations applied to the throat, chest, and abdomen. This treatment in almost every case reduced the temperature of patients, and in a day or so, they were apparently well. But that did not end the matter with them. The next danger was that of relapse. To guard against this, every patient was required to remain abed from 2 to 5 days after apparent full recovery, according to the state of their flu affliction. Again, rest gives your immune system the strength that it needs to fight this virus. So if you are not getting appropriate rest at this time, God has given you an excuse to do it. He's shutting down the country so that you can get rest. As a result of this system of handling a disease that is scoring thousands of victims every day, there has not been one case that could have been called serious or a single death at the seminary, although there were more than 90 persons affected. The record is remarkable. It makes the ordinary methods of dealing with the flu appear irrational. We will add that we are indeed thankful to God for his protecting care and for the untiring efforts of Sister Louise Mutzen, our seminary nurse, and for the assistance of the other nurses and helpers. The hydrotherapy treatments under the blessings of God are indeed helpful and as is recognized in this article. And that was by MP Nielsen. So do we have anything today? Is this even being done today? I was surprised to find that my old, I say old because it was many years ago, my old professor, microbiology professor at Loma Linda University School of Medicine, has published a book back in 2000, and well, let's see, this is 2013-2020. He may have brought it out again, but it looks like this was published some time ago. This is a book that he wrote at the time regarding not this SARS epidemic, but the SARS epidemic back in 2002, 18 years ago. And that is a book that I will give Rodney a link to so he can share it with those that are there. He basically goes through and describes, first of all, he describes his two failed attempts to get his letter into the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet. It's no surprise. But he also describes in detail how he treats some of these ailments. And to that effect, this is not your only good resource. I also want to, before we close this, because it is we've got just a limited time, I'm going to end on an excellent resource if you guys don't know about it. And that is this site that was sponsored by ASI that Rodney had a hand in as well, that he can answer questions about, called godcareseveryday.org. You can get to it. And on this site is just amazing resources. Not the least of which is under natural remedies, which I'll click on here so you can see. And you will see here, this first video is amazing. But this second video here really goes through very well in detail about exactly what is hydrotherapy and how does it work. Again, do I have randomized placebo-controlled data showing that it works? I do not. At this point, though, what we need to do is we need to flatten down that curve if we're going to save lives. And right now, why I went to medical school, why all of you are interested in this as well, is I didn't go to practice perfect medicine. I went to save lives. And that's what we need to do at this point. If the benefits outweigh the risks, if we're not here to practice, don't let the good be the enemy of the perfect. So with that, Rodney, I will, should we have a prayer or should we open up for questions?
Yeah, I think we have maybe a couple of minutes for some questions. I would like to ask a couple myself, and those who specifically registered for this meeting on the Zoom invitation, you're welcome just to put a question or two in the chat window. But one of the questions that I had as I was looking through the different things you were sharing was that chart on maybe the first or second thing showed a surge coming potentially in the fall.
Okay, so this surge, so first of all, I will clarify that this is a study put out by Great Britain, for Great Britain. And so, but I think there are some things that we can take from that. Great Britain has a slightly older population than we do, so there it may be a little bit exaggerated compared to us. But they started with their epidemic at about the same time that we are. And so I think the surge is probably predicted for early May, late April. There is a graph up here that kind of tells you where they actually look at Great Britain and the United States. And their prediction is that deaths per 100,000 population, they anticipate, because of their slightly older population, that they're going to have a higher peak in terms of ratio, not in terms of total, of course, because they're a much smaller nation as a whole. But yes, they do say that the U.S. peak may come a bit later. Now, this is based on data from February, so it may be needed to be updated a little bit.
Okay. Another question is regarding the temperature, the body temperature, and when the immune response was at its height. That showed 40 degrees centigrade. That's 104. That's a pretty intense fever. So,
yeah, so that's a good question. So where was that? That was, right here. They said that the mobility, phagocytosis, and killing of bacteria by polymorphal nuclear leukocytes are significantly greater at temperatures above 40. So here's the key though, Rodney, and I'm glad you're setting up this question, is the purpose is not to raise the core body temperature of the patient. The purpose of this is to raise the local temperature where the virus and where the immune system needs to go. So if the patient's temperature starts to rise, you can always put a cool towel to cool them off. So the purpose of hydrotherapy and this heat transfer is to pick the portion of the body that you want to get. And we know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus loves the ACE2 inhibitors, sorry, the ACE2 receptors in the lung, and that's where they're going to stay. So if we can keep the rest of the body cooled down, but really apply a tremendous amount of heat to that area, 4 to 6 hours, every 4 to 6 hours, this might be what we need to just, again, remember, we can just move that 80% up enough, that can have a tremendous impact in who goes to the hospital.
That's fantastic. Thank you for clarifying that and sharing that with us. Another question is regarding the sleep aspect. I believe and I agree with you that it seems like we have been given a perfect opportunity now because we're chronically sleep deprived and now we have to sleep. I mean, we have the time to sleep anyways. So in regard to sleeping, are there any better hours of the day or night for us to sleep, or does it not really matter? Just sleep wherever you can get it.
Okay, so I know that there are a number of statements that people are probably aware of where the hours before midnight are twice as good as the hours after midnight. What I would say is there's something called a circadian rhythm that says, okay, if you feel sleepy at this time, and this is the time that you feel like you should get up, then that's the time that you should really get your hours of sleep. We may be in a situation because of all of the things that we've done for the past number of years that we don't feel sleepy until 11 o'clock at night. And we don't feel like we should get up until 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I have a teenager that's like that. I think we all kind of know how that works. But this is something that you'll notice. Generally speaking, people who are older like to go to bed early and get up early. People who are in their adolescence like to go to bed late and get up late. I wouldn't try to buck that at this point. I would say go to bed when you feel like you're ready to go to bed, but don't try to stay up late and don't expose your eyes to light because that's going to delay your circadian rhythm. One thing you'll notice, if you are someone that would rather go to bed earlier, but you don't feel sleepy until later at night, as you start to get up in the morning and expose your eyes to light, your natural circadian rhythm will start to move that sleep time back. And you'll start noticing that you'll get tired more easily in the early hours of the evening. And those are the most important hours. I think the key point here, Rodney, is that as soon as you feel like you're ready to go to bed, because there's a special kind of sleep that you get at the very beginning of the night called slow wave sleep. And that is very important in restoring your immune system and restoring your health physically.
That's excellent. We have two more questions. We'll take Michelle's question about how much sleep is recommended.
So it's really dependent on age. If you are an adult, you really should be getting more than 7 hours of sleep per night. It's better if you get 8 hours of sleep per night. If you're a school-age child, high school student, college student, then you really ought to be aiming for 8 to 9 hours of sleep. High school students should be getting 9 hours of sleep per night. And as we start to ramp down the age, going into elementary school, kindergarten, toddlers, that number goes up even higher. You know that small babies sleep for a long time. There is a very good reference on if you go to the AASM, which is the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and you type in that, they will show you a nice graph where you just find your age and it will tell you what the optimal number of hours of sleep are.
Fantastic. And finally, the last question from Joanne is, a hot dry sauna is good while keeping the head cool. That's in the form of a question. So is a hot dry sauna good while keeping the head cool?
Yeah, that's kind of what we're doing here. This is what we're talking about. This is not the only way to do this. It's probably one of the most aggressive and highest in amplitude. But doing a hot shower and getting cold water, that can stimulate a hot spa and getting out and having a cold exposure. You don't want to do the cold for too long. You don't want to leave cold water and get a chill. You want to wipe it off right away and make sure that you're dry, that you're not overcooling yourself, because that's not healthy. But Rodney, you probably know more about this than I do. And that site that I was looking at has a lot of good recommendations about exactly how to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah, we are planning to put more resources on that ASI website, God Cares Every Day. So I just want to encourage those of you who are watching this to check that site on a regular basis. It will be updated and we can continue to learn and practice as we go.
I was just going to say one thing, Rodney. I really truly believe that this is something that we need to do, and we need to share it with as many people. There are people dying right now for lack of knowledge all over the world because of this virus. And this, if this does work, this is something that they need to be able to hear. I don't know if it's going to work, but it doesn't sound like there's a lot of risk in doing it, so long as you don't burn yourself on the stove doing this. So please share this with as many people as you possibly can.
If you could bring up the website for us on your browser, I'd just like to show our viewers. You see at the very top, it says sharing resources. That's one of those tabs. We've developed a couple of things that we'd like to encourage you to share. There's a Facebook picture for your social media. And then also, if you want to print out postcards and give people the postcard that will highlight this particular website, you can give that website to people when you're going out and practicing social distancing, of course. But, sharing this with people can be really a powerful tool. You mentioned Dr. Benjamin Lau, and we are planning at the Mentone Seventh-day Adventist Church. We were planning to have them in person tomorrow. That's our regular health club day. It's the fourth Sunday of every month. But we are still planning to do our health club, but it's going to be online. So I would like to encourage you, if you're interested in participating in that online, the information is there on our Facebook page, mentonechurch.org. Also, it's going to be on there. But you can register for that, and we will have time tomorrow at 1 p.m. with Dr. Benjamin Lau and his wife, Esther, and they're going to share with us. So you can bring your questions to them tomorrow as well. So I think that's everything for today. Thank you again, Dr. Schwelt. We really appreciate your time to be with us. And we will continue to do these kind of things. Next week, we'll hopefully be able to do something again. So any closing words to share with us? And then if you would pray in conclusion.
I just can't say enough that I believe that the Lord is working. He is bringing things together. He has a plan. Remember that people die for a lack of knowledge. And this is the time that we are here. We're here for this. And so realize that we do nothing of ourselves on our own, but it's through the power of God. And let's pray now. Dear Lord, please be with us as we spread your word, and we elevate the right arm of the message and have it to go through to people who are desperate for hope and desperate for anything that is going to work. Please let this message go out and be a salve for those who need it. In thy name, amen.
Amen. Amen. Thank you for joining, everyone. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.